Good morning, everyone. It's approximately 9 a.m. on Thursday, July 26th. This is the time scheduled for the Utah State Tax Commission public meeting. I'm Commissioner Bruce Johnson. With me is Commissioner Mark Johnson, Commissioner Darcy Dixon Pignanelli, and Commissioner Michael Cragen. Also up front is our Deputy Executive Director, Scott Smith, who's filling in for Barry Conover, who's on annual leave this week. And our Administrative Assistant, Krista Johnson, is taking the minutes. Is there any public comment to come before the commission at this time? Seeing none, we'll move to the next item, which is to consider approving commission meeting minutes of Thursday, June 14th.
It's Commissioner Dixon, I move approval of the minute.
Any discussion to that motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That appears to be unanimous, actually. Item number four on our agenda, approve the submission of proposed rule amendments. Commissioner Cragen?
Thank you. We have two proposed amendments to our administrative rules before us today. The first is an amendment to R861-1A12 dealing with the policies and procedures regarding public disclosure. And this came about because of some discussions that we had with the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division in the spring, where they expressed a desire to have us mail copies of our orders to automobile dealers that employ the licensees or license applicants who are appealing the decisions of the division. And frankly, their desire is that the division wants the employers of the licensees to know what our decisions are and why we have made the decisions. We felt like that we needed to make a change to our rules to make it clear to the world that those decisions are public orders and that those orders will be distributed without any redaction. In the process of doing that, we decided that it was high time that we clean up this rule as it was to make it match current practice and statute and to eliminate obsolete or outdated information. Further in the process, we found that there may be some conflict with the law that the legislature passed two sessions ago dealing with Open and Public Meetings Act. And this draft of the rule actually applies that statute, and the commission affirmatively says that all hearings except for those that are dealing with Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division licenses are closed, and says that except as otherwise required by other rules or statutes, that all orders except for the MVED orders are not public orders, and the only way that we will release them is through our redaction program. I think that covers all of the substance of the rule, and I'm reasonably certain that there's some discussion on it, so I won't make any motions just yet.
Okay, is there are there questions for Commissioner Cragen or discussion to the rule?
I have a couple. And I'm not sure the best way to approach it, but maybe I'll just start by going through item by item. Apparently we've made the decision that tax matters are closed meetings, confidential tax matters. And while I understand we can make that decree, I'm not sure why we're making that distinction, especially for residential property tax hearings. And I'm not disagreeing, I'm just not understanding why we are making that decision, particularly when I believe it's, I can't remember if it's Section 404 that deals with confidentiality. Seems to make a distinction between residential property tax taxes and commercial property taxes, or taxes that have confidential commercial information. And specifically, I believe it says that, if I'm recollecting correctly, that the residential ones are disclosable and in some cases have to be disclosed. So the distinction here, I'm just not clear on.
You want to respond to that, Commissioner Cragen?
Yes. One thing that I wanted to correct in what Commissioner Johnson said, but I think it may have just been a misstatement, is that it's actually by statute that confidential tax matters would be closed, that the public cannot participate in hearings dealing with tax matters. The statute also says that when we're dealing with property taxes, as opposed to income taxes or the corporate taxes and the other ones that are specified by statute is closed, that when we're dealing with property tax, only commercial information is protected by statute. So what we're doing in this, what we're proposing with this amendment, would be to close property tax hearings, which is, we are given that discretion by the statute that I mentioned that was passed at two sessions ago, to say that our hearings are closed. But that is a change in practice. And as to the why, I think it's just because we're trying to be consistent. We're trying to have all hearings except for the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division hearings handled in a uniform manner, so that we don't have confusion as, what kind of hearing is this? Is it open or is it closed? And so forth. And I also have my note from Lynn Solarzik, where I have to say that any appeal that comes from the Division of Motor Vehicles, so dealing with license plates and so forth, would have the same treatment as locally assessed property hearings. So whichever way we decide we're going to go, we need to remember to handle those both the same way. So even though Lynn is away, let the record show I remembered to say what she told me to say.
Could you repeat that last part again? I didn't follow a couple words. Could you just repeat that?
Yes.
Thanks.
When we're dealing with matters arising from the actions of the Division of Motor Vehicles, they are not covered by the confidentiality statutes.
Mm-hmm.
So they come under the same category as the locally assessed property. Whatever procedure we decide to employ with respect to locally assessed property, we should also employ with respect to Division of Motor Vehicle Appeals.
And so we treat locally assessed property the same as motor vehicle?
That's the suggestion, because they are both of those categories of appeals are not covered by the confidentiality statutes that apply to income tax and the other taxes.
All right, that's gone way over my head. So the reason we're closing appeals filed with the commission under 1A pursuant to section 49105, hearings related to appeals filed with the commission are confidential tax matters, and hearings related to motor vehicles are not.
Okay, you have to remember that we've got two motor vehicle divisions. It's the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division appeals that are not.
But okay. All right. Thanks. Yeah, right. And so 41 Chapter 3 Motor Vehicle Business Regulation, those are which of the two? I just don't remember.
MVED.
MVED. And what motor vehicle is under what title and chapter?
It's Title 41, and I believe it's Chapter 1 of 1A.
Okay.
Is Brad here?
So we're still treating 41 chapter, the motor vehicle in 41 chapter what?
1
uh-huh.
and 1A.
1 and 1A. Those are still being treated the same as tax matters. Appeals filed with the tax commission are under 59-1405 as tax matters.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And 49-105 covers 41 chapter 1 and 1A.
I can't answer that question definitively. I don't know.
Well, are we dealing with, other than what the statute that requires motor vehicle wants to be treated the same as locally assessed property taxes, are we dealing with that separately as we do other tax matters and?
Yes, if you'll look at lines 57 through 60 on the second page, you'll see the Title 41-1A, the Motor Vehicle Act.
Okay. 57 orders relating from a hearing.
Am I, oh, okay, I've got two versions. One's numbered, one isn't. So what were the lines again? 57?
Well, I said 57, but that's actually, yeah. It's starting on line 57. And going through 65.
57 through 65?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm let me make sure I haven't got the wrong one here, because.
Am I not working from the same document that they were working from?
What?
So it's not like
this
with the line numbers on
it? Okay, that's a number. Okay, I'm reading the same thing. So when we say that the hearings under 1A and 1B are treated separately, and 55 then deals with the orders from a hearing.
Correct.
Okay. I'm not sure I understand the answer. Let me think this through. So hearings are not subject to the Open Public Meetings Act for tax matters. Hearings for MVED are not are open to the public, and orders from 41-1A will be mailed. I'm not sure how that says that the hearings are not.
It doesn't.
Okay. What I'm wondering then, again, maybe I didn't state it clearly, is why are we specifying orders for tax matters pursuant to 59-1405? Then we have separate hearings for 41-3, but we don't have any specifications for hearings relating to 41-1A.
I don't know.
Okay. I think I would. I would probably not, just on that basis alone, would probably prefer not to support this rule, at least until I understood a little bit more about that. And so my question there is, or does anybody else know? Maybe I'm just missing something. I'll take that as a no. Okay.
And I would just make the comment that all appeals that we handle are under our authority of 59-1405, but it probably would be more clear if it specified in the rule that the hearings under 411A, for matters under 411A, are also included.
Yeah, and my reason for that is I'm not sure, maybe they are, but I'm not sure they're all tax matters. And it says right here in the rule that they're confidential tax matters. So I'm probably a little goosey about myself, not suggesting that anyone else follow my direction. And then I guess my next question is, starting on line 33, we're saying that, maybe down to 37, property tax orders signed by the commission that do not contain commercial information will be mailed essentially sanitized unless a party requests that they not be satisfied. I'm shortening it, but that's how I read it. Maybe I read it correctly. So we're saying unless you ask for them not to be sanitized, we're going to sanitize them. It seems to me just to be simpler to say, if you want a copy of the order, just ask for it.
Well, I think that what this section really says is that the parties to the appeal will receive the unsanitized versions. Anybody else can only have an unsanitized version unless the parties to the appeal agree that an unsanitized version be released to third parties.
Oh, I see. Let me. There was another part that.
And this is the section starting on line 37, lines 37 through 45, that would be a change in practice. Well, a change in potential practice. It's actually consistent with what we've done so far, because we haven't really had a lot of people ask us.
Now, so the parties have affirmatively waived any, on line 41, the parties have affirmatively waived any claims to confidentiality. So we're saying we're not going to mail them a copy of a order that does not contain confidential commercial information unless they have affirmatively waived any claims to confidentiality.
The parties get the order.
Yeah.
Without any sanitization.
Right.
Third parties get an unredacted order if the parties affirmatively waive their claims to confidentiality.
Okay. So then, or the disclosure is required under state law. Does that mean does that mean the parties still have to affirmatively waive the claims to confidentiality if the disclosure is required under state law?
No, it's an or.
Okay.
So if the court says, for example,
that's how I read it.
You've got to give this to us, then the parties can't preclude
that. So residential locally assessed property taxes they're not required to be disclosed under state law in an unredacted version.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
I mean, they may be in certain circumstances. Again, a court could require it in the course of litigation.
Yeah. I think I still need to go over the does that relate to the confidentiality statute at all, where it distinguishes between commercial, non-disclosable commercial confidential information and locally assessed information, which is generally not subject to confidentiality under that statute?
Well, I think the problem that we're trying to address is that, and Commissioner Cragen, correct me if I'm wrong on this, we had a pretty clear rule, I mean, to the extent that the commercial information statute was clear, and it was not clear. It's a horrible statute. But
we knew we had that provision, and we knew that we had the distinction between commercial information and non-commercial information and property tax. Then when we had the, when Senator Valentine put through his bill at our request, which created this concept of designating tax or controversies as confidential tax matters, so we could make sure that we didn't need to rely on the deliberative privilege in case law to have confidentiality for our tax matters. I don't think we focused at that time on how those two interrelated. And so then when we're looking at the rule, and we address the rule because of the motor vehicle enforcement thing, we realized that we hadn't, that our rules had not been rewritten to take into account the fact that we have this new statute that Senator Valentine passed. So what we're trying to do in this is to reconcile Senator Valentine's amendment to the statute, the confidentiality provisions, and also make sure that that all conforms with the policies that we've adopted for our redaction program. And so we're trying to get this all in one place so all of those things are consistent. And you know, to the extent that we've been successful, kudos to Lynn. To the extent it's still a little confusing, I suspect that we will have to, you know, work with this a little bit and see how it works. I think there is some pressure is probably the wrong word, but there is some immediacy in terms of getting the procedure in place for motor vehicle enforcement, which was what motivated this in the first place. So I think that's something that we probably need to move ahead on, and to the extent that we can get comments on this and you know, maybe make some changes in it if we need to before it's finally adopted, I think we can do that.
Unfortunately, the way that the Administrative Rulemaking Act works, we don't have the luxury that the legislature does to make an amendment.
Well, I understand that. We'd have to begin the process over again. But I guess what I'm saying is if we determine that this is, after the comments, we determine this is better than what we've got now, mm-hmm. but additional changes are necessary, then when we find out what those additional changes and clarifications are, then we can publish those clarifications and go through that process and further refine the rule in the future.
Commissioner Johnson, I just wanted to kind of go back to your question of why we wrote the proposal this way. And I think the shortest answer I can give you is that it seemed inconsistent to apply the discretion that Senator Valentine's bill gave us to state, to declare that our hearings are closed, and then to not also say in this rule that the orders that come out of those closed hearings are also going to be kept confidential.
Hmm. Well,
That is a policy decision that the commission as a whole has to make. This is just a draft order that, or a draft rule that we can change if the commission as a group doesn't want to make. And Lynn Solarzik and I also discussed what happens if we get a 2-2 split in this situation, and I reminded her that in this situation we're not in an appeal. So when you have a tie under parliamentary procedure, the motion fails, and so nothing happens.
Oh. Well, I'm assuming it would pass 3-1 anyway, so I don't know that we have to worry about it based on the comments I've heard. My last one, I'm not too worried about this, is especially on locally assessed properties, which are not subject to the same confidentiality. Those locally assessed, probably residential properties, maybe vacant land, that are not subject to the same confidentiality restrictions in 404, I guess it is. I'm not sure I care for the geographic information from being withheld. So I think you've addressed my questions, but not to my satisfaction, so I don't think I need to discuss it any further.
Well, I might ask Commissioner Dixon to respond to the point on geographic information. I think that was her concern.
Yeah. Just to make it clear, the redaction program has been a long-standing part of the Tax Commission, as far as I can see, back to the 1980s. And going back through many decisions that were redacted at that point, it has been a long-standing practice to redact out exactly what is shown in this wording, which is the orders may be effectively sanitized through the deletion of references to the parties, specific tax amounts, witnesses, geographic information, or any other information that might identify any private party to the appeal. That's been a long-standing practice, at least as far back as I can find, for at least 22 years, and I have found decisions that went back further than that. And it was my understanding that we should be very careful about changing long-standing practices through rule. And there were, prior to the understanding and our decision as a commission to up our compliance with the Open Public Means Act, there were many discussions regarding redaction when I started with the commission in 2006, and when I took over the redaction program to make it a more regular practice of getting decisions redacted and out, because we're developing case law that the public has a right to see and understand and know. And we had many discussions about this, including with the administrative law judges, to make sure that we understood why and our policies and procedures and practices for that. And so I know those weren't part of the public record, but at that time we were doing, commission meetings, a meeting with the ALJs as part of deliberations. And in addition, in terms of the geographic, because they are posted on our website, and that's part of a search engine, I have had discussions with DTS, and those parties who set up our website, and there has to also be a sense of how can you make it searchable for the public. And so it's not only that in a taxpayer situation, you can have a very specific property that if it's known by a county, it's just identifiable. And we have several of those. But also that geographically, if you can say that it's rural, that makes it a little bit easier for people to search things that might be more helpful to them in putting together an appeal based upon the difference between being in a rural area maybe versus being in a more metropolitan area. So there were many factors that went into it. My fellow commissioner, Mark Johnson, and I have had discussions on this. I went personally to his office, explained to him how we got to that I'd pulled multiple decisions, gone back through it.
Did you mean Bruce Johnson?
No, I was going to get to that. When I heard that my fellow commissioner, Mark Johnson, had concerns, I went and met with him and said, these were the only two items I put in, one of them being geographic, the other being witnesses, to make it consistent with practice. And I did meet with our commission chairman, Bruce Johnson, to explain why I was requesting those two terms be in, because I think it consistently met what had been going on for at least 22 years, if not longer. So that's just so it's clear. And I understand my fellow Commissioner Mark Johnson and I have had a discussion about this too. So.
Well, I think I'm done.
Okay, I well, we don't have a motion. I assume we'll have a motion shortly. I mean, I kind of still view this as a work in progress. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that because the proceedings are closed, that the orders have to be similarly protected. That seems to make sense, but I don't know that it's necessary. We might find that there are good reasons for, having the decision once made to be public. I personally am hopeful that we would get some input from the taxpayer community on this. I know, Richard, Mr. Van Komen, you don't do a lot of property tax, as far as I know, but you might bring this to the attention of some of the taxpayer groups that you work with. I know that some concerns have been expressed by the counties by the property tax division that we may be depriving people of a good teaching tool if we redact some of this information. Sometimes when you redact the information to protect the identity of the parties, you end up with a decision that's pretty much unintelligible and you can't really tell what it's talking about. So I would hope that we would get a lot of comment on this and continue to think about it and make sure that our assumptions make sense and our proposal makes sense. But I think what we've got now is kind of a muddle, and I think this is better.
Okay. I was going to mention that I know the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division has adopted the practice of mailing copies of the orders out themselves under their statutory authority to notify the public of their enforcement actions. Their request was that we just send them out as in the normal course of our publishing orders to the parties, and this rule change is necessary for that to happen. But in the interim, they have found a way to make sure that dealers are aware of the information that the division feels like the division or the dealers need to know. So we do still have some time. As I look at the calendar, I believe it's going to be the 27th of September before all four of us are present in a commission meeting again. If we approve the publication of this rule today, it will be submitted to the Division of Administrative Rules no later than August 1st for publication in the August 15th register. It will then be subject to public comment until the 15th of September. So the first commission meeting at which we could adopt this rule as it's proposed would be the 27th of September, the next meeting where all four of us will be together. If we choose not to put this forward, we can work between now and the 27th of September on a different version of the rule that addresses the issue of should we close the locally assessed property tax hearings or not? And if we close them, should the orders also be kept confidential or made public despite the fact that the hearing has been closed? We could continue having that discussion. We'll have a couple of meetings in which three of us would be present, could continue the discussion, and perhaps the fourth could participate by telephone. And we'd be at the same spot. The 27th of September would be the day that we could then publish a new amended rule. A new proposed rule amendment and start it through the public comment period. So I guess it doesn't matter what we do, the calendar is going to be the same. It's going to be probably November or December before we get a final version of the rule done.
Mr. Chairman? Just, Commissioner Cragen, let me ask one other option. It seems to me at one time we submitted two versions of the same rule, and because we weren't sure which way we wanted it to go, and we wanted public comment on both, and then we let one lapse, and the other one we made effective. Is it also an option? And I'm not necessarily in favor of this option. I'm just asking, so it's part of the dialogue, that this one gets submitted. If in the meantime work is done and there's another version, could that go up simultaneously in the other one? One go and one lapse, I mean.
Yes. If we're going to pursue that option, I would recommend that we not approve publication of this one today so that they can go simultaneously. I think that that's the best option.
To have it go simultaneously?
Yes. I believe that, as I recall, you will be unable to participate in the August 9th meeting, so I guess I'd want to know, if we decide to go that way, would you be okay with us, the three of us, voting to send up the two rules on the 9th of August so that we can stay ahead of the calendar a little bit?
You know, my preference is to be a part of the dialogue, because I was a part of this one, and I have no means to be a part of the dialogue between now and the 9th.
Okay.
So I just don't have a means to do that.
Okay.
So I mean, I do up till, you know, about August 1st, but after that, I'm just not available.
So realistically, it'll probably be September 17th before we could employ the dual track option.
Okay.
September 27th, mm-hmm. I set the date wrong.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to just say one other item about the the locally assessed property tax hearings that deal with residential. We know that there's a lot of information about property tax that's public information. Everyone can look it up online and go find that. They need, just in general, because there's a lot of people that aren't a part of locally assessed property tax hearings that might be interested in this, is that there's a lot of property is very personal to people, especially when it gets to be their home. I mean, we can look at the factual part about how many square footage and how big the acre is, and you know, how many stories, and you know, when was it last updated. Those are very factual, but a home is very personal to people, and I'm not saying this means that it matter shouldn't or should not be confidential, but I think this is where the line bleeds a little bit. It's that it's so personal to people, and I think, not to wax too philosophical about that, but that was kind of many of the foundations of coming to America, was this principle of the right to own property and have your own home and have it be kind of a private place. And people get into these hearings and they say really personal things. I mean, they talk, and I know this is stuff that can be redacted out, but they talk about their health. They say things about their family members. They, you know, they say things that maybe in a lesser situation they wouldn't say. They talk about things that you worry about whether it, you know, it would compromise their security, it would compromise their family situation, and I think we've just always said at that point it just feels so much more confidential. And when we write our tax hearings, because we want taxpayers to feel like they were heard, we put a lot of that in, and I could give examples of that, but if a taxpayer is going to come to a hearing, the most important thing to them is that they were heard. And sometimes if you don't write that into a tax order, they don't feel like they were heard. And so I think that's another part that I just want to put into the record, that there's a lot here. There's a lot here we're trying to sort through. It's not that clear sometimes. And the other thing that I want to make clear is that I'm not sure I understand that it's a change in practice that our locally assessed property tax hearings aren't closed. Case in fact, I've hosted several people from other foreign countries who came here to learn about our tax administration and our tax appeal process. And it was always my understanding when we spoke as a commission in meetings, again, this was prior to us upping our compliance with the Open and Public Meetings Act, I said, okay, I'm hosting these people. They'd like to be part of the hearing process. Okay, locally assessed, yes. Commercial, no. But we still asked every taxpayer in that, property taxpayer in that room, can this person stay? And they had to agree to let them stay, or they had to leave. And I've done that multiple times, and we've had discussions about that. So I was always of the opinion that even in a residential property tax case, that there had to be an agreement that a public member could stay. And I just wanted to make that clear.
Could I just make one response to that last mm-hmm. point? If anybody had ever pressed the matter and demanded the right to stay, we would have had to acquiesce until Senator Valentine's bill passed, and we then adopted this rule saying they're closed.
Okay.
So as long as nobody presses the issue, you are correct. Our practice is that we exclude people from our hearings.
Okay. And just so it's clear, that was never part of the dialogue when we talked about it in other public commission meetings, and Commissioner Craig, and that was probably before you started as a commissioner. Okay. But anyway, just for what it's worth, I just wanted to put that into the record.
All right. For what it's worth, I appreciate your comments. But I will tell you, I come from a completely different point of view on that. The Constitution of the state of Utah says that the courts are open. Generally, when you bring a matter to a public agency and you ask the government to act, the presumption, I think, in the Constitution, we're not a court, I acknowledge that, but the presumption is that those are public. That when you're conducting the business of the public involving private entities, that it's still public information. And property tax, particularly when you bring facts to the commission that you believe affect the property value of your home, if your property value goes down, other people's tax burden goes up. And so I think the public has an interest in knowing exactly what we are considering on any particular property. And I understand that people may wish to keep information confidential, and I've had many taxpayers who have said, I've got information about environmental contamination or something else that I think would affect the value of my property, but I don't want to go, we're not ready to go public with it. And as long as you're not ready to go public with it, then you don't bring it to the tribunal's attention. And I recognize, I appreciate what you're saying, but I think that's one of the key differences between property tax and income tax. My income tax doesn't affect anybody else. But if my property tax goes down, my value goes down, it affects everybody else in every taxing district in which I'm located. And I think they have a right to know exactly why the decision was made, so they can make sure that they're being treated fairly. And to me, that trumps the confidentiality, and the taxpayer always has the ability to choose not to disclose information in a tribunal if they don't want it to be public. But I think there are obviously arguments on both sides of
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, isn't that the point of the redaction program, though, is to get our decision out there? I mean, just eliminating the confidential names, health issues, private stuff, and just get out there that here's our guidance, here's what we decided. Haven't we done that through the redaction program, gotten the information out there online on a regular basis?
Well, that's certainly the compromise, but I'm suggesting is that we might get to the same place, but I'm coming at it from a
from a different direction, I think, than you are. And that's what we're trying to figure out. So,
can somebody give me a signal what I'm supposed to do?
Well,
are we going to send this thing forward, or are we going to hold it and work on it some more? Because I get both messages from my colleagues.
I'm hoping I'm not sending a confusing message.
No, I'm getting one message from you. You don't like it, but you don't care if we go forward with it.
Well, I do care. I don't like to see anything I don't like go forward, but okay. That's your all call.
Well, my preference, if it were my call alone, would be to go forward with this and maybe be even a little bit more aggressive than we usually are in getting public comment. Now, I recognize that there's nothing that precludes us from reaching out to UAC, from reaching out to the Taxpayers Association and saying we're going to propose a rule, we want to get some public input before we do that. Well, we could certainly do that, but proposing a rule has the benefit of galvanizing people to act sometimes when they wouldn't otherwise. So if you were to make a motion to go forward with this, I would vote in favor of it, but I certainly understand the countervailing
And that's true, notwithstanding the philosophical statement you just made. I thought that your philosophical statement would be counter to this proposal.
Well, it is, but okay. but given the fact that I'm trying to, we need to reach a consensus, and I was, as I say, Commissioner Dixon and I kind of started different places, but that's why there are four people on the commission. Because we have different views, and hopefully bringing different views, we come to a consensus that's good policy. I would be comfortable disclosing more than this rule discloses. But I think this rule reflects a very good attempt to reconcile three different kinds of statutes. We've got the taxpayer information statute, the return information statute, we've got the confidential information statute, we've got motor vehicle enforcement, which is a different kind of law enforcement deal altogether. We've got those three different areas of responsibility. We've got different statutes that govern them. We've got the whole overlay of our redaction process, and I think this is a step forward in reconciling and rationalizing all of those things. So I'd be prepared to support it, but I recognize that it's important that other people feel good about it as well. So that's kind of where I am. I think we know where Commissioner Johnson is.
If not, would you like me to clarify further?
Commissioner Dixon, give me some. What's your preference?
I prefer that we move forward.
That we move forward? Okay. And I would make a motion that we submit the proposed amendment to R861-1A12 to the Division of Administrative Rules for publication in the Utah Register.
Okay, is there further discussion to that motion? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to comment? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Okay, Commissioner Johnson votes in the negative, but that motion passes. Well, that was easy. Let's go on to the next one.
All right.
I appreciate that. I think that's a great discussion. I would say, I think we'd benefit from input from other interested parties.
The next proposed amendment that we have is an amendment to Rule R873. This will be a new subsection that we add to Rule 8, R873. This is R873-2942. And This is dealing with legislation that passed in the 2012 session, creating a non-repairable certificate for certain motor vehicles, and we are required by that statute to promulgate a rule establishing how an insurance company proves that it meets the statutory requirements so that it can receive the non-repairable certificate. And I would mention on this one that the timing is important. I believe this rule needs to become effective in October 1st of 2012, since that's the effective date of the statute. We want the rule in place when the statute becomes effective. So today is the day to submit it, because September 27th would be the day, the first date that we could, first commission meeting where we could take action based on the calendar I previously explained. Mr. Simpson is here if we have any specific technical questions, but I think it's essentially the legislature passed the statute, required us to make a rule, and this is the rule that is prepared in response to that statutory requirement.
Any questions for Commissioner Cragen on this one?
I move that we submit R873-22M42 to the Division of Administrative Rules for publication in the Utah Register.
Any discussion to that motion? Any comment from the public or others on that? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That motion passes unanimously. Thank you. All right, Commissioner Cragen, item number five.
Okay.
You ought to get double time for these meetings.
Is that an option? Okay, we've got eight rule amendments that have been through the publication and public comment period. I am not aware of receiving any public comment on any of these rules, so unless somebody gives me the high sign saying they want to do it differently, what I propose to do is explain them all and make one motion to adopt them. But if anybody wants us to vote separately, I'm happy to.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question on one of them, so it will be the first one, just so Commissioner Craig knows.
Okay, all right. This is an amendment to Rule R8672B. It's actually a repeal of subsection 4, and the reason that we are proposing to repeal, all right, this is an amendment to R8611A20. And this proposed amendment actually came from our administrative law judges, indicating that that the rule was not clear that on the time period for appealing an action by the Motor Vehicle Division and the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division, that those appeals must be done within 30 days of the division's notice. And so this rule is making it clear that it's 30 days. That was the practice. There was some argument from others that statutes and other things established the 30-day time period, but the administrative law judges asked if we could make it clear. So with that, Mr. Dixon.
I just had a question on line 48. In the case of electronically filed documents, the petition is received no later than midnight of the last day of the 30-day time period. What constitutes electronically filed? Does that include faxed, emailed? Because I know in our JustWare, our software program, we've discussed that down the road there'll be maybe the opportunity for a taxpayer to open up a file in JustWare and file their petition. But does that include faxed and emailed?
I would think that if a taxpayer were to make an argument that they faxed in a document by midnight of the date of the last day of the 30-day time period that under this rule that we would have to say that they had timely filed.
And emailed as well, because that would be electronic?
Yes. Now, okay. I do have a question on that I've wrestled with as I've discussed this particular section with folks is what time zone do we look at? The time zone from which the email originated, or our time zone at which it arrived, mm-hmm. and we'll deal with that in some future
when we get it.
When somebody brings it up.
Okay. That was my question.
Did you want to send a motion on this?
No, no. I just wanted to understand.
Is there any reason not to make that explicit that it's the time zone at the headquarters of the tax commission, the entire state's in the same time zone?
And that's a good point, because we're dealing with licensing issues, so everybody's going to be in Utah. I guess I was thinking.
Well, but they might not be. I mean, they might send it in from someplace else, but I guess it just seems to me that even if they send it in from California, they need to know it needs to be here by midnight Mountain Time.
Right. I think we could put that on our list of cleanup provisions the next time we go through.
Yeah, I don't see any reason to wait for an appeal. let's give them some guidance. I wouldn't suggest holding this up to make that and I agree that the Division of Administrative Rules would probably, or may at least consider that to be a substantive change. Mm-hmm. But I think we might as well, as long as we've identified the issue, we might as well address it. But we can do it at a future date.
Okay. I'll write that down. Okay, next on the agenda is an amendment to Rule R865-6F. Deleting language from subsection 6 of R865-6F to make our rule conform with case law and changes to the Multi-State Tax Commission model rule. Yeah, I'm not aware of any public comment on this. This all seems to be the deletion stuff somewhere there. Next on our agenda is an amendment Rule R865-19S. R865-9I. This is a request that came from the Utah Educational Savings Incentive Plan Trust to give them a couple of extra months to be able to get their report to us. At the beginning of the year, they have to get out their statements of account to the holders of the accounts, and so they would like to be able to wait until March 31st to send us the report that is the culmination of all the reports they send out to their account holders. Now we're looking at R865-12L, dealing with subsection 14. This is a change that came about because of legislative action in the 2012 session and conforms with the implementation of House Bill 476 dealing with telecommunications, sales and use tax, and telecommunications charge distribution and redistribution. Now we get R865-19S-1.3. And this is coming about because of House Bill 157 from the 2012 session of the legislature dealing with specie legal tender, establishing what we do if there is not a London fixing price available for a day on which a purchase is made in specie legal tender. Essentially, we say we look at the most recent date in which the London fixed pricing information. Now, R867-2B is an amendment to subsection 2, And this amendment is a repeal of subsection 2. This comes about because of the legislature adopting Senate Bill 243 in the 2012 session. And because Senate Bill 243 repealed the statutory sections under which this law, this rule was created, we have to repeal the rule. And that's the same thing. No, that's the one I started with. Okay, now we're going to look at RA672E4.
Can I just ask, maybe ask Mr. Sandberg a question on that? This is the Illegal Drug Stamp Act that was repealed, but we will still have the authority to do jeopardy assessments under other taxes. Is that correct?
I am not familiar with the jeopardy assessment process. We don't get involved in that. That's taxpayer services.
Okay. That was, for the record, that was Craig Sandberg, the director of our auditing division.
Okay, so I was correct. 867-2B4 is also a repeal that comes about because the underlying statute dealing with the Illegal Drug Tax Stamp Act was repealed. So we're repealing this subsection 4 as well. And finally, Danny, are you aware of any counties published their valuation notices yet? I haven't received mine, so they were supposed to go out this last weekend, weren't they?
Yes.
I received mine.
Oh, I received mine.
So they are out. Yeah. We needed to take action on this rule because this deals with appeals that are going to be coming about from those tax valuation notices that are going out this week. And these are, we made some significant changes to R8424P66 earlier this year. And in the process of making those changes, we received input from the county assessors asking us to make explicit information that must accompany an appeal application. And that's what this amendment does. And we wanted to get it in place so that the assessors and the public know how to handle Board of Equalization appeals this year. So that's the purpose of this amendment. All right, again, I don't have any record of receiving any public comment on these 8 proposed amendments. We have met all the requirements of the Administrative Rulemaking Act, and so I move that we adopt these 8 amendments as presented with an effective date of today.
Is there any discussion to that motion? Any comment from the public or people present? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. I believe that was unanimous. That motion will pass. Item number 6. Is that also yours, Commissioner Cragen?
Yes. Have this item put on the agenda out of an overabundance of caution. I think the argument could be made that I probably could have just unilaterally authorized this purchase, but because it is dealing with an existing contract and is going to subject us to future obligations to pay for these licenses, I thought that I would bring it to the meeting. We entered into a contract with New Dawn Technologies and purchased a case management system called JustWare. And when we entered into that contract, we purchased 20 user licenses. And I've given you a list of whom those 20 user licenses are assigned, to whom those are assigned. And at the same time that we made that contract, we also purchased services from New Dawn Technologies they're identified as business intelligence hours. Essentially, it's service hours where their programmers will create reports for us or help us to create rules, business rules within the case management software and so forth. We're coming upon the second anniversary our implementation of JustWare, and so we find that we don't have a lot of need to use all of those business intelligence hours. We have about 54 hours remaining. Michael Rusin from the Division of Technology Department of Technology Services, who supports us in using this application, has recommended that we trade those 54 remaining business intelligence hours for an additional two licenses, and that we assign those two licenses, one to Neil Hood, who is his backup in the Division of the Department of Technology Services, so that Neil can be using the system and be familiar with it, so that when Michael isn't here, that he can be an effective backup for us. And then have an additional one for some future need. I do know that if you noticed on the clerical staff, we've got one license assigned to an intern. At the moment, we happen to have two interns working for us, and so they can't both be in the system at the same time. So an additional license would allow both interns to access the system simultaneously. If we go ahead and ask Newdon to make that swap for those business intelligence hours, then beginning next year, we would need to pay an additional license renewal fee of about $600 for each license. So we'd have a new obligation starting next fiscal year of $1,200 for those two new licenses. Now, we think that that can be handled within current budget resources, but as I say, I thought it was best to discuss this with my colleagues rather than doing it unilaterally, and because of the nature of the decision, I thought we had to do it at a public meeting. So that's the explanation. Are there any questions I can answer before I make a motion?
Questions for Commissioner Cragen?
I had questions, but they weren't necessarily for Commissioner Cragen. They were really for Michael Rusin, who I guess forgot to come today or something. Anyway,
I can get my best shot.
I know. Yeah. Well, I wanted to understand, can an additional license be added at any time as long as it fits within the budgetary constraints? I mean, there's not a certain date. Are we doing this because the cost will go up, so we want to lock in the cost?
We're doing it now so that we can take advantage of being able to convert the money that we've already paid to Newdon for business intelligence hours to license. That opportunity will go away at the end of this month.
Okay, so that's the urgency of it. Okay,
yes.
But there's no time frame with which you can get a license. I mean, you can call up tomorrow and get another one.
Anytime
as long
we've
as
got money, they'll sell us a new license.
Okay.
The urgency here
is this.
To take advantage of our contract.
Okay, that's exactly what I wanted to make sure of. Okay.
And then cancellation of the license is good for a year. So if you wanted to cancel it in mid-year, it wouldn't make any difference. You'd have to wait till the next year to cancel it.
That would be my understanding, but
that's what would make sense to me too. But
they may have some sort of
proration
with a refund as well.
That's possible.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one other thing, kind of that same point. If we get to the point, if we can get those at any time at the same price, you know, next year we may decide, well, we don't want to pay $595 just for the possibility that we'll need an extra one. And we can make the decision at that point to not renew that extra license.
I would say yes, that's true. Okay.
Any other questions?
No, I just have a comment that the deal notwithstanding. By the way, is business intelligence the same as military intelligence? I don't know how that all works, but maybe you can't answer that. Anyway, I think the price is worth it just to have a backup for Mike Rusin. So I'd pay for the additional license anyway. The fact that we got a good deal on it is just icing on the cake.
And I would agree that we certainly need that for Neil Hood. The one that I would be concerned about is the second one, which is just for future needs, if those future needs don't.
Yeah, but like you pointed out, we have a year to think about it, so I agree.
All right, any comment from the audience?
I'd move that we approve the proposal to convert the business intelligence hours to two additional licenses.
All in favor, say aye.
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 All right, that passes unanimously. Thank you for your attention to that matter. The next item is the executive director's report. Mr. Smith.
I don't have anything.
That was an excellent report. Succinct.
Him more instead of Barry. Yeah.
note to Krista. Schedule for commissioner's reports. That was not intended to disincentivize any commissioners from reporting.
Yeah, nonetheless.
All right, at this point I would entertain a motion to go into private session. Commissioner Gragan, help me if I need better language, to go into a confidential session to discuss litigation matters.
Confidential session is what we do for the waivers and compromises, so this is a closed session.
Closed session of the public meeting. Do we keep the recording going and not
yes.
take minutes?
No, we keep the recording going and we take minutes.
And we take minutes.
Pending litigation that we want to discuss.
I can never remember.
To make you a chart.
No, we just need to keep you here so you can answer all those questions.
I'd move to go into closed session to discuss pending or reasonably imminent litigation.
All in favor, say aye.
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 That aye. Is unanimous. We will come back to adjourn, but I would suggest to members of the public that you probably don't want to hang around for that. Thank you very much.
Now, Chris, did you want us to stop the recording and restart it so that you can find it? Okay. This one you can actually edit it.
Okay. Well, to that point, though, if somebody wants to listen to this, they can, right?
Yes,
a member of the public.
We can make it.
So we probably ought to end it. So if somebody wanted to listen to the public part of the meeting, they could without having to worry. So at this point, we will stop this recording and this.